Europe acknowledges the traditional owners of the land this podcast was recorded on. We pay our respect to their elders past, present, and emerging, and extend this to all First Nations people. Hello and welcome to Sustainable Forces, a podcast by AREP with me, your host, Dr. Michelle Dickinson. In this podcast, we explore the incredible ways that people join forces to tackle some of the world's most pressing sustainability challenges. In our last episode, we delved into Scope 3 emissions, those often overlooked emissions embedded in the value chain of the goods, materials, and services that we purchase. We learned how the property industry can address these hidden emissions by collaborating with suppliers, driving innovation, and rethinking material use. Today, we're building on that conversation by focusing specifically on materials. Materials are the foundation of our built environment, yet we often know very little about the sustainability of their origins, how they're made, and their life cycle. To explore these ideas, I spoke to Flemming Voltman, Vice President of External Relations and Sustainability at Velux Group, a global organization that has been bringing daylight and fresh air into homes for over 80 years through their roof windows and skylights. I also spoke to Martin Powley, Director and Global Circular Economy Services Leader at AREP. Together, we discussed how materials can balance people's needs for comfort and functionality with the urgent demand for sustainability and cost efficiency. Our conversation touched on the complexities and exciting possibilities of a circular economy, including fascinating insights into glass recycling. We also imagined the future of materials and shared actionable steps that we can take to achieve a more sustainable built environment. It's a thought-provoking discussion that I hope you'll enjoy as much as I do. Hi, Flemming. Welcome to our podcast, and thank you so much for joining us today from Copenhagen. Can you tell us a little bit about your role, what you do, and share a little bit about what your organization does?
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. So, I'm the Vice President of External Relations and Sustainability at Velux. And at Velux, we provide our customers two very essential things. That's daylight and fresh air through our roof windows, skylights, sun tunnels, and so on and so on. And I think, you know, it's pretty well known to most people the importance of daylight and fresh air. And we're happy to be, you know, the world's largest global provider of that.
That sounds delightful. And Martin, you are joining us from Berlin. Can you also share a little bit about what you do at AREP and some of the projects that you're involved in?
Yeah, very happy to. And also thanks for having me. I'm the Global Circular Economy Services Leader at AREP. So I develop circular economy-based business and product strategies for leading companies in the construction industry. That's the external role. And on the internal side, I help driving our global circular economy strategic direction. I manage some of our key client relationships. I also manage our partnership with the Ellen MacArthur Foundation and provide overall mentorship and guidance towards the global teams.
So today's episode is sort of a continuation from our last episode where we talked all about reducing Scope 3 emissions. Now, today we're going to focus specifically on materials in the built environment. And as a materials engineer, I'm very excited about today's episode. So I'm going to start with you, Martin. Why is understanding and maybe even changing or modifying materials so important to reduce Scope 3 emissions? And are there ways that we can be using materials more sustainably?
Yes, definitely. I mean, we all know that the construction industry or the construction sector globally contributes significantly to the carbon problem and to climate change. It also contributes significantly to waste problems. So we have problems with respect to material productivity, resource scarcity, etc., etc. So materials or the established materials, cement, aluminium, steel, glass, or the so-called hard-to-abate materials, because it's difficult to get the carbon out of the production and supply chain processes, as they are very energy intensive. And that's why the shift towards the embodied energy within those material supply chains is so important. And that is what we call the reduction of Scope 3 emissions. So why is it important for organizations and for businesses that have like a large throughput of materials and resources, they usually have a significant scope 3 footprint. Many of those companies have implemented measures with respect to scope 1 and scope 2, but scope 3 still for many remains the must-win battle. In some cases, 85 to 99% of emissions are in scope 3. And that is putting pressure on businesses as they sometimes operate at low margins and the prices for carbon increase. So they might lose their license to operate, if you like. And that's why they're addressing their scope 3 emissions by addressing and reorganizing their material supply. For design projects, it's also, we see an increasing pressure as more and more countries are implementing specific carbon reduction measures and targets. So you get a budget for a building permit, that you can only meet those whole life carbon targets if you double down on bringing your embodied carbon and the upfront carbon of materials down. So materials get more and more into the focus, and we can clearly see a lot of opportunities, but also challenges. But I guess we'll allude to that throughout the podcast.
And Fleming, look, I know your company is a skylight company, right? I have first encountered you from making holes in the roof so I can see the sky. So I'm thinking from materials, I'm thinking about a glass and there may be a frame around it. Now, I know you do so much more than that at VLUX. So can you tell us a little bit about some of the products that you have and what you're doing to make the processes more sustainable around material use and even reuse?
Just on what Marty was just talking about, our scope 1-2 emissions, where we have a target of getting to zero. It will be close to zero very, very soon. That's about 3 or 4% of the total emissions, right? So that's, of course, also why we, you know, invest heavily in reducing our scope 3 emissions. Here we have a target of reducing scope 3 with 50%, which actually is you know, before 2030. And that's actually a very, very ambitious target. And let me explain why it's ambitious. So you can say that most of those emissions will come from aluminium. Then secondly, they would come from steel, and then they would come from glass and various polymers. Then you have a very long list of other materials, but also stuff like, you know, transport logistics, but actually also end of life with the products. So what we've done is to take, you can say, sort of list, you know, big on big things, small on small things. So we started with aluminium as a critical, you know, material to us. You know, it's hugely important to the product itself, its durability. It's a lot of emissions. The good news is that the aluminium industry themselves are also working very seriously on decarbonization. So that, you could say, make our job a little bit easier because then, of course, you know, we work with our partners within the alloy industry to buy low carbon or lower carbon aluminium. Steel, more or less the same. They might be a little bit more challenged from emissions point of view. And then, you know, glass, which is maybe the most important component in our product at the end of the day, you know, is also a little bit troublesome because it also comes with significant emissions. And here the industry, you know, might be struggling a little bit or trailing a little bit behind compared to, for instance, alloy and steel.
So let's just dive a little bit further into the fact that you are leading in this space and you are, you know, a large organization that can do that. Do you think by sort of making your target to zero as your goal and doing that early, do you think some of the smaller organizations are sort of pushed forwards by your momentum?
Yeah, I think that you can definitely inspire other companies within an industry because, you know, it's a whole lot easier for others to take, you know, that jump to have an ambition like we do if you can see other companies succeeding with it, right? And that's also why, even though our scope 1-2 emissions are the smallest ones, we decided to go to zero and do it super fast because, you know, you have a 100% influence. Whereas, you know, scope 3, much more significant, but our influence is, of course, a lot less because, you know, fundamentally, I can't buy materials if they don't exist. So that's also a little bit of a longer journey. The partnerships we have with Alu is great because that hopefully will encourage the aluminium industry to continue to invest into this. And another component to it that is talked about sometimes, but I think sometimes maybe it's underestimated, is that someone has to be willing to pay a green premium. So we've been very vocal about this, and we have a separate budget item actually to buy low carbon alloy and buy low carbon steel, because we believe that, as Martin referred to, those so-called hard-to-abate industries, you need, you know, really some significant changes. And they're very costly. It also means that those industries need long-term contracts that is what you would call bankable, so that whenever they have to change, you know, their facilities or build new facilities, you know, they need maybe contracts that's 10, 12, 15 years long that they can actually help finance that transition. And I think sometimes, you know, people a little bit underestimate that, you know, these are huge industries. They've been around for a long time. If you were to start totally from scratch, you know, getting us to a low-carbon society would be relatively easy. But, of course, we're stuck in our part of the world. I'm based out of Europe, but it's the same in Australia. It's the same in North America, right? We have a long heritage. We have, you know, a lot of buildings, infrastructure, but we also have a lot of industries, and people have invested into those, and they're not going to go away overnight. But, of course, had we started completely over, it would have been a whole lot easier. But we have to facilitate and also finance that transition.
Yeah, Martin, Fleming's making this sound very easy over here. I think, you know, they're making great choices around sustainable materials and adopting sort of a circular approach. Now, it's not as easy as it sounds, right? So you know that there are some challenges around this. Can you share some of those? We've mentioned a little bit about financial, but what other challenges are there?
Yeah, there are definitely challenges that are inherent to the construction industry. And I think Fleming alluded to some of them. At the, let's say, systemic level, the industry is incredibly energy intensive and incredibly fragmented at the same time. Assets have a very long life cycle, so it's challenging to implement circularity measures, for instance, like in the fast-moving consumer goods industry. So I think that's kind of at the more a broader level. Then there are specific value chains, and Fleming also mentioned some of them, where it's much easier to focus on decarbonizing material supply chains. Aluminium, for instance, has a long-lasting tradition to have recycling schemes, for instance, but other industries, it's more difficult. Glass, for instance, it's difficult to establish for instance, float glass recycling scheme that is helping to decarbonize glass for the construction industry. Cement, are the same. Here we see that industry leaders are making great progress by collaborating along the value chain. Fleming mentioned that also. I think what we see at the moment is that companies are overcoming that challenge of acting in isolation and securing IP there, instead collaborating along the value chains, building new, very meaningful partnerships upstream and downstream to overcome those challenges. So overall, I think there are much more advantages than challenges. And I think this is what we need to focus on. And some of those advantages are definitely related to emerging business cases, new business models that we see emerging as part of that shift to a circular economy.
Yeah, Fleming, I just want to come back to something that Martin said. So he talked about float glass. And so float glass is the type of glass that we would use in windows, for example. And I think most people are used to the type of glass that maybe, I don't know, their bottle of cola would come in, or their wine, perhaps. And they're very different types of glass. So if I think about glass, I think, well, it's easy to recycle glass, right? We've got all of these different, you know, my supermarket as a place that I can do this. But float glass is very different. Can you just explain float glass as a material and why it isn't recycled in the same way?
Yeah, let me just maybe start by sharing a couple of statistics that might put it a little bit into perspective. So we looked at a study done in just within the European Union, and out of the float glass or the glass that's also used in buildings, no, it's about 1% that gets recycled currently. I mean, 1%, that's an amazing low number. 40% then, in all fairness, get downcycled, so that means they might come back as bottles or marmalade jar and what have you. And then 60% roughly, right, ends up in a landfill or is crushed and used in other materials. I think that, you know, There's a couple of fundamental things going on with these type of materials and why they're not being recycled. One, of course, is the economics of it. So is you can say it's the, you know, buying something that is completely virgin is that significantly cheaper than recycling? Then obviously, yes, we have a problem, right? And that's where, again, you know, learning from the metals industry is very significant, right? Because that's materials that never lose their properties. So whatever we need to use them for, you know, whenever you recycle them, they will still have the same qualities. And they have a price where people actually bother to recycle them. Let's be honest, right? And that is to a lesser degree the case for the glass. But then, of course, the glass also maybe from a process point of view is more vulnerable for contamination of the processes if you get materials back where you don't know what's in the material. And that's, you can say, one of the disadvantages that we have in the built environment is that the glass we might recycle, that was glass that might have been produced 40 years ago. So you actually don't know necessarily what's in it, right? And I think also most people can relate to that. If you take down an old house that's 50, 60 years old, you know, you might have cables that's full of lead, you have other materials that's full of these things. And then running a new factory today, you don't want that to be contaminated with what was basically in the processes 50 or 60 years ago. So I think there's some economics and then there's a little bit around the processes, and you don't want that to be contaminated. We do believe that can be overcome, right? So one of the things that we are working on is a take-back scheme in the Netherlands, where we try to ensure that the flat glass remains in one piece so that it's not broken. And our providers, where we buy the glass from, they can actually recycle that. The problem is, and I think most of our listeners can imagine, that's a little bit of a handheld exercise these days. But I mean, most things, you know, started by being very handheld, and then eventually you invent machines and you figure out how can you do this at scale so you don't have to have people that has to dismantle a window to ensure that the glass is not broken. But that's where we're at today. But of course, you know, I'm super optimistic that you can find ways to make sure that these processes are less handheld. And then you know, then you drive down the cost, and then it becomes much more attractive for people. Subject of carbon pricing, of course, also helps, right? Because the more the producer have to pay a carbon price, and then you don't have a carbon price on the recycled materials. I mean, we still got to work both on the technical part, but we also need to work also on some of the economics of it.
And it's always that balance between sustainable and economic. So let's talk about a different balance. Fleming, I'm going to stay with you. Sometimes the best material for the job is not the best material for the planet. So you're having to make some compromises around sustainability, but also around making sure you've got the right material. So how are you balancing people's needs and comfort around your products with cost and sustainability when it comes to choosing materials?
Yeah, so we have, you could say, sort of a couple of approaches when we design new products and when we look to redesign our existing products. Right, one, of course, is our carbon footprint, where we have the target of reducing that by 50%. That also goes all the way down to we want to reduce per window with 50%, because that also makes it very, very tangible for our people in our R&D department, right? But then at the same time, we have two other things that we always look at. That is biodiversity and it's the circular economy. And we believe that, you can say, circular economy is maybe the biggest opportunity to decarbonize, because, I mean, that's a little bit of a no-brainer. You use more recycled material. Potentially, you can prolong the use phase of your material, and you make sure that the materials are actually recycled, maybe even upcycled. And then today, you know, we're, as an industry, you know, almost starting from scratch, right? So there's huge opportunities in front of us. And then at the same time, we always have a little bit of, you know, also strong focus on biodiversity. And that's where I think you're totally spot on to say that, you know, some people might naively think that there's always synergies across the border. That is not the case. There's some of the materials that are easy to recycle, but they come with high carbon emission factors, and they might be bad for the biodiversity and so on. So we try and always take that holistic approach. And beyond, you can say, that triangle between biodiversity, emissions, and circular economy, of course, for us, front and center is our customers to deliver a product, you know, that's high quality. And there's a small component to that that we look into, that is, can you prolong the life and the use of the material by 10 years? You know, then you serve your customers well. You actually definitely also significantly reduce the emissions factors. But could you maybe also refurbish older windows coming back? So we're looking into that. So let's say, just for the sake of the argument, that a window is less than 20 years old. Can we then refurbish it and sell it back into the industry? Can we refurbish it while it's still in the building? Then you also significantly reduce the emissions. And most of our customers would actually be happy about that, right? Because that is cheaper, you know, it saves time and so on and so on. Historically, that's not how the industry works. The industry is entirely linear. So yes, in theory on PowerPoint, this is super easy, but we talk about thousands and thousands of people out there, not just within our company, but also the craftsmen who had to go out and work on this. But I just sense that a lot of people, you know, very, very willing to do this, but also slowly that this is what customers expect from us.
I like that, Martin. We've just talked about this linear mindset. And actually what I'm hearing is there's lots of opportunities for new ways of doing things and new ways of thinking about things and maybe not bringing all of that history with us. So surely there's lots of opportunities here. Can you share with us some of the benefits that you've seen for organizations or maybe new businesses being able to embrace this approach? And are there any examples that you can share with us?
Yeah, definitely. So Fleming mentioned some of the kind of the emerging archetypes as part of a circular economy. He was talking about reusing components, refurbishing, recycling. And I think that is an entirely new framework, if you like, for organizations to innovate and for designers to design. On the organizational side, as Fleming said, yes, the majority still is based on entirely linear logics and models. So you take a material, you turn it into a product, and you sell it to a customer, and often you lose any track of that. So there are, if you systematically explore opportunities in your kind of current business model, you will always find new opportunities in that circular economy logic that will help you creating customer value, but also business value. But that is taking time, as Fleming said. Small scale pilots exist, but transforming an entire value chain or industry will take, I guess, 10 to 15 years. Still, we see that some of those small scale pilots work, and also the business cases that are often looked at very critically, because there is usually a lack of an economy of scale. If you refurbish one window in a school or a hospital, you're still lacking scale to really identify the business cases. However, we've seen examples where that works. We've been, for instance, helping a large brick manufacturer to look at a take-back scheme of brick, refurbishing it and selling that as refurbished bricks into the markets. And we are always focusing on the industrial circular economy, because in the past we've seen very, let's say, literate examples where you take a material out of one building and put it into another one. That's fine to test that at small scale. But at the same time, we really need to focus on the entire industry and on opportunities for every partner or every actor in that value chain to create value. I think this will ultimately unlock a new momentum. On the design side, again, it's a fantastic framework for innovative designs. If I look at Arup and our people, that design transport infrastructure or buildings that take circularity as a lens, they're completely rethinking the way they design. So they start at very early stages by just looking at what materials are out there that could be reused, that are refurbished, that are existing. Could be, for instance, use existing steel beams for a structure. And that then unlocks an entirely new way of thinking, which is really fascinating and inspiring. So these are, let's say, some of the opportunities where I also, as circular economy services leader, look very optimistically onto what we've achieved collectively in the industry. 5 years ago, that looked entirely different. And now we are seeing more and more momentum. We have policy instruments that work. We have industries leading the way, defining new partnerships. We have designers designing for it. So that's all very positive, and the opportunities are crystal clear. And I think there are more to come.
And if you maybe just can share two examples of that, because I think you're totally onto something here, Martin. I recently visited an old factory in Oakland, California, and that was literally a factory that is in an industrial zone, and they converted that old plant into apartments. And there's, you know, super, super nice apartments, and you even have apartments, you know, straight in the middle of the old factory, because then you have a lot of skylights. And they were beautiful, and everyone lives to be there, and it was very hip and what have you, right? So that just takes a little bit of imagination, but the carbon footprint, of course, of that factory now converted to our apartments is 85% less than it would have been if they would have done what you normally do, tear it down and then build a high rise. And then, of course, you need the politicians to play along, right? Because then you need to make sure that you have a zoning law that supports it, because now this was in an industrial area. Can you have apartments in the industrial area? That's something we discussed quite a lot in Copenhagen. Yes, that gives opportunities to kind of rethink and repurpose the city and some of those fundamental structures that are already in a city. And so I think that there's an enormous opportunity. I also recently saw an old cigarette factory in Florence that has been converted into educations. And up under the roof, they now built the most beautiful apartments I've ever seen. And a lot of that, but you still look like a cigarette factory. And it was beautiful, right? And again, the carbon footprint, the material spent in that one is you know, significantly less than you just, you know, tear it down and build something super boring, high-rise type thing.
I love it. I now want to see the picture of this cigarette factory apartment.
It's beautiful. It's really amazing, right? The point to it, and you were also saying, Martin, of course, we all like these things, right? Because we remember them and they're beautiful. And the reason why we remember them is that they stand out. Because, you know, majority of what we do is still build things that is very unsustainable, super, super boring, and not very pleasing to the eye, probably not good for the people within the building either. So we need to figure out how do we get away from these sort of cute, nice examples of something done, something extraordinary, but then that should become the norm going forward, actually. And that would be interesting if we reconvene 5 years from now and then it becomes, there's a 200th example, and not just one, you know, interesting example of some of these things.
Well, this moves really nicely onto a part of our podcast that we call The Power of Partnership. And you've both just talked about different industries coming together, rethinking the way we're doing things, not being in silos anymore. And we know that collaboration is essential for driving our industry forward. So can we talk a little bit about partnership and maybe partnership with industries that we don't normally partner with to find some of these solutions? Martin, you talked about, you know, Arup thinking about the transport industry and that coming into construction and how these things can be connected. Fleming, I'll start with you. So do you have any insights into what partnership means to you and your role at VLUX? And maybe if there's been some unusual partnerships that have come out of this that are positive?
But I would say that our success is entirely dependent on partnerships. Our CEOs always explain to us that, you know, partnership is the new leadership. Okay. And I think that's really key. So, you know, we partner with the suppliers of the materials, right? I spoke earlier about what partnerships we have on aluminium, we have on steel, we have new partnerships coming up on glass. So that's about driving down emissions, having a higher recycled content within it. But then we also have, at you can say, the end of the use of the materials, we have partnerships currently in the Netherlands. We're running a take-back scheme. But again, we know we're the world's biggest, most successful producer of roof windows, skylights, and so on and so on. We're not a recycler. So there we partnered with a recycler because, you know, they have a long history. They have a long tradition of being, you know, super at recycling. And then we link them up with our providers of glass so that we help create a little bit of a closed loop in that. So we basically facilitate it. That's what that partnership role looks like. We have other partnerships where other people actually utilize our waste streams. So we have several types of waste streams within our factories, and we want to become, you know, we want to have zero waste. But part of that is actually offering what we consider waste, something valuable to other companies. Just one example is that some glass that we don't use, you know, is actually used by other companies. And the same goes for some wood residue that we would have on site because we use a lot of wood for the windows. We utilize some of it, but other residues goes to other people. So I think that there's so many opportunities in that space to look across your entire value chain and partner up with people, right? And again, it's also about being humble and understand, you know, we might believe that we're the world's best producers of windows, but we're definitely not the world's best recycler. Far from it. Actually, you know, we probably would do a pretty poor job of it. That's why I think these partnerships is fundamental to our own success.
Amazing. And Martin, you must see the power of partnership every single day in your job. So can you share a little bit about what partnership means for you and what you're seeing in your role at Arup?
Yeah. So if you look at Arup and at the global level, we also have our global strategic partnerships together with organizations like the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, for instance, or the World Economic Forum, WBCSD. to really kind of make sure that we are leveraging our internal expertise, that we join forces to kind of influence systems change in the market. And we can use those partnerships to really kind of amplify what we know, what others know, and to avoid that we are constantly reinventing the wheel. With the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, for instance, we have started, it's a 10-year old relationship. And part of that was the development of the Circular Billings Toolkit, for instance, which would not have been possible in isolation. And that's just one example where we can leverage both strengths of the organizations to then provide something to the market that is openly accessible, that everyone can use, and that helps kind of unlocking that systems change and rethinking designs. At more local level, what we see is that our offices, our groups, geographies also build local partnerships to, for instance, fill some gaps that they have when it comes to, for instance, retrofitting buildings. In Germany, we are partnering with a small company called Kochula, who are helping us, for instance, to get into an existing building, take stock of all the materials, develop that materials catalog that then ARIP can work with to assess whether those materials or components can be reused or recycled. So what I want to say is, it's the same with Velox. We need to build partnerships to fill certain gaps that we see to create value in that new circular design and circular economy world. And I think it's important to really systematically explore where those gaps exist and then be very open what it needs to fill those gaps. And in some cases, it can be filled by startups or emerging technologies. In other cases, we also see that established businesses, for instance, demolishing companies, rethink their own business model and by kind of joining forces with other industry leaders. So overall, partnerships are absolutely key. New coalitions are absolutely key to unlock that transition to a circular economy.
And can I maybe, Michelle, point to a partnership that I'm missing? Because one thing is that you cherish the ones that you have already, right? But one that you could say maybe possible with is the entire public sector. And the reason why I bring that up, of course, is that, you know, in some of the countries that we've spoken about today, whether it's North America, whether it's Europe, whether it's in Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and elsewhere, you know, the majority of the buildings and the infrastructure is somehow either owned or operated by the public sector. And I think that, you know, their success rate in doing this is a little bit mixed. Let me try to be polite, right? But that's where, to the point that Martin raised earlier on, how do we get scale out of these things? We're going from these small, nice, cute pilot projects to something that's scalable. And that's where I think that the public sector is actually missing out on that. And the public procurement and the entire tendering has been, I think, for too many years focused only on what is the upfront cost. And you wanted to buy whatever is cheapest. And whatever is the cheapest right here, right now, you know, very seldom you serve you really well in the long run. And it is often very, very unsustainable solution, actually, also for the people who either live in a building or work in a building, right? So I think that there we need to maybe also, you know, rethink a little bit our perspective on cost and look at the cost through the entire, you know, ownership and then lifetime of the built environment. And I think here again, whether it's municipalities, whether it's states, other agencies, I think that they also need to maybe step up to the plate and help us out a little bit here. So, you know, we could start with schools, we could start with other things. That is something that you could easily identify. But where all the science tells us that you can significantly reduce the amount of sick days for the teachers and at the same time also significantly improve the learning environment for our children. So for me, that would be a no-brainer. And that would be a little bit on my to-do list if we could work, for instance, with the public sector on some of these buildings that are key to all the citizens.
I guess the people who put pressure on public sector are the public, right? So is it up to us to sort of raise these issues also, not just around cost financially, but cost to the planet and cost to our people? Martin?
Maybe just to build on what Fleming just said, I think he's absolutely right. The public sector has a massive purchasing power, and they have a massive power to create a demand for more sustainable, decarbonized, and also circular solutions. And that correlates with a long-lasting interest in their assets. So they are not turning over assets every 3 to 5 years. They are owning them throughout the entire life cycle and potentially many life cycles in the future. So they should have an inherent interest to rethink the way, as Flemming said, they procure. And that could be really, that could become a bit of a tipping point in the industry, because then we would have that also customer demand at scale. And the public sector also has the ability to somehow kind of cluster their procurement. There are 10, 20 hospitals and school buildings to be built. And again, that goes back to overcoming that challenge of fragmentation and small scale. So I think that's really potentially like the next chapter of industry change.
I feel like if you're listening and you're from the public sector, we're looking to you to help us make this change. Look, we're almost out of time, but the part of this episode that I love is usually by this point, everybody who's listening is totally inspired and wants to just get doing something, start somewhere, but maybe don't know where to start or don't know what to look for. So this is what we call sort of our tips and tricks section. So for the people who are listening who want to learn more, is there a top tip or a top insight that you can share with them that helps them to maybe get started on this journey or think more about scope 3 emissions or think more about materials? Anything that you think will help people on this journey? Fleming, I will start with you.
Yeah, well, I might then point to something that I think, you know, it's very, very trivial, but that's on data. So if I can, I might share two examples. So of course, being a little bit of a climate and energy nerd myself, I got a smart meter in my own home, and the smart meter basically just allows you minute by minute to monitor your own energy consumption in your own house. And since I got that, my own consumption of electricity has gone from 20 kilowatt hours per day. Now I'm down to 4.7. And that has been pretty easy, but that was just literally by having the data, you know, and that awareness. And you just downloaded an app. I did that in 2013. And you know, everything is better. You know, I don't compromise on any of the comfort that I would need, but I think that's very significant. So gone from 20 kilowatt hours down to 4.7. If everyone had done the same, that is actually quite spectacular. But we've done the same also at the company level. Today, we use exactly the same amount of electricity as we did in 2010, and the company has grown more than 250%. So that is sort of, you can say, constantly trying to improve, but also recognize that we, you know, we need big innovation, big change, but sometimes we also need a lot of incremental change at the same time and not underestimate the one percentage point here and another percentage point here. You know, we need everything. Everything counts, right? So that's what we've done at the company level. Energy efficiency first across our entire, you know, fleet of factories, offices, and everything. And then we convert it to 100% renewable electricity. And I think that, again, whether you're a mayor in the city or you're an individual with your own house and what have you, right, I think people should do the same journey. And it is actually, to be honest, quite easy once you figure out how to get those data points. And I think once you see some of the data points, and, you know, I think it can be quite intriguing to challenge yourself to drive down the numbers, again, without compromising on your comfort and what else you might, you know, appreciate.
I'm curious, what was the thing in your home that you found was sucking the most energy that you didn't know?
Yeah, so the first step that I did, and this is definitely also a good trip, is to look at what is the electricity consumption at night when you're asleep. Because then you fundamentally don't want to use electricity when you're sleeping, because then there's some machinery that could be a freezer or something else that is not working right. So then I was looking at that. I changed that. Of course, I changed all the light bulbs. And you know, that actually took it from 20 down to 10. And then, you know, it's just been over the years when I had to change a few things. I always buy what is the best energy label products. That took me then down to 4.7. And I still have, admit, you know, a dry tumbler, I still have a dishwasher, I have a lot of these nice things, right? So it's been without compromising on any of these things, right? So I think, you know, yeah, that's very much doable, but you need to focus on it. And I think that's also where, again, you know, leadership as a company, you know, is important, but also leadership within our own life.
And we've talked a lot on this series about data and the you can't change what you don't know. And so collecting data is a big part of it, but we know it's challenging around scope 3 emissions. We know there are challenges there. Martin, top tip, what would you like to share with our listeners?
Maybe two things. One is related to data. I think we increasingly need to move towards more tangible targets, because it's hard for us to navigate the complex sustainable development agenda and global agendas. Having clear targets and benchmarks, for instance, for a building design or for a piece of infrastructure, will definitely create that clarity for everyone along the value chain. A target that we can work towards, that we can measure, is something that I would say is one tip. So really look out for existing benchmarks and targets and work towards them. And the other one is potentially a slightly more generic tip, but I think it goes back to our individual but also collective attitude towards sustainability, circularity, and decarbonization. If I wake up every morning and I'm convinced that this is the right thing to do, and I have the courage in every project and every conversation that I have with partners, with clients, with other leaders to really kind of make that point and raise awareness that this is important, that this also does something, not only with myself, but with the teams and with entire organizations. I think that's it for me.
I love it. And that's what we're doing today, which is surrounding ourselves with like-minded people so we don't feel like we're doing it on our own. Fleming and Martin, thank you so much for sharing all of your insights, especially around materials. Fleming, congratulations on all the things that you're doing and leading in this space. It really is a significant change to the whole industry. Sadly, that is all we have time for. So thank you for your time.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
Well, that was a fascinating conversation, which highlighted both the challenges and the opportunities around rethinking materials for a more sustainable future. I don't know about you, but I was really surprised to learn that so little of the float glass produced for windows is actually recycled. It was also great to hear about the inspiring examples of what's possible, from the creative reuse of old factories into beautiful apartments, to the emergence of startups tackling the challenges faced by some of the more traditional construction industries. It is clear that when we work together and embrace new ideas, we can transform the way that we design, use, and think about materials in the built environment. In our next episode, we will tackle an important question. How inclusive and active is your city's transport? Join us as we speak to Sarah Kandarachi, Arup's Global and Europe Social Value and Equity Leader, and Henk Swarto, President of European Cyclists Federation. And if you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe to Sustainable Forces on your favorite streaming platform.